It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn. Governor Tony Evers' new two-year budget plan calls for nearly $150 million to address PFAS contamination. It's the latest step in years of state government efforts to deal with toxic forever chemicals in the environment and drinking water.
PFAS are a group of more than 15,000 types of chemicals that are slow to break down. And according to the Environmental Protection Agency, exposure to certain levels of PFAS has been linked to developmental delays in children and a rise in some cancers, among other health effects.
In recent years, Evers and Republican lawmakers have clashed over how to clean up PFAS, with a $125 million fund set aside in the last budget going unused as the parties argue over provisions for spending the money and regulatory authority.
To learn more about the science of detecting and destroying forever chemicals, we're joined by Gavin Dehnert, an emerging contaminant scientist with Wisconsin Sea Grant and UW-Madison. Gavin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you for having me and excited to talk a little bit about PFAS.
Yes, Governor Evers' new two-year budget proposal calls for over $145 million to address this pollution. What are some ways that communities can address PFAS contamination in their drinking water?
I think the first question that we're all kind of asking right now is, do we have PFAS in our water? So one of the first kind of big ways that we can do this is actually going out and testing for PFAS, whether that be in our private wells or in municipalities. But kind of the first step to this is actually testing to see what levels we do or potentially don't have.
And testing can be costly. I mean, we're looking at Governor Evers' budget, and he's setting aside a proposed grant program where the bulk of the funding goes to test municipal water systems. Why is it so costly?
So the first idea behind this is, you know, the original tests for PFAS, where we could actually only look for about 16 analytes, they could run anywhere from, you know, $500 to $600 for a single test. So it is quite expensive. Now we are able to test for more PFAS. We are kind of up to about 40 analytes right now. Those prices have gone down, but they still do run about, you know, $350 to $400 for a test. So it is quite expensive to test for PFAS. And part of the reason behind that is we are able to test at extremely low levels. So there's a lot of people power that go into preparing the samples so we can detect them at such low levels.
Where do you get the samples from usually?
You can get water samples, whether they be from surface water, if your drinking water is coming from surface water, or if it's coming from groundwater. If it's a private well, we can actually grab water samples directly from an outside source or potentially even from inside the house. But for like a municipality, they will have a kind of a water source for us to analyze.
And how accurate are these tests? Do you feel like they're very confident in the results?
These tests are very, very good at detecting levels that are extremely low. So we can actually measure down to what we call nanograms per liter or parts per trillion. And these are accurate all the way down to, depending on the analyte, a single nanogram per liter. And they have the ability to tell us, you know, whether or not it was 1 nanogram versus 2 nanograms per liter. So very, very high accuracy in telling us that information.
I've always wondered if scientists have the ability to make PFAS, nearly 15,000 of these synthetic chemicals and counting, and that's from the EPA estimates. Why can't scientists also have the ability to destroy them and break them down, make them inert?
Yeah. So that's part of the beauty and the problem with PFAS themselves. So what makes a PFAS is they have a carbon to fluorine bond, and that is one of the strongest organic bonds that is known to exist. So it takes a lot of energy for us to actually break that bond. And that's the reason these PFAS chemicals have been labeled as forever chemicals, because once they're created, they can have very long half-lives. Or what I mean by that is it takes a very, very long time for them to break down. And that's due to that, how strong that carbon to fluorine bond is.
What unanswered questions then do scientists have around the scope of our state's issues with PFAS? What don't you know now?
So I like to always say is we know less than what we don't know, if that makes any sense. So when I give a lot of talks about PFAS, we get a lot of questions about, you know, where are PFAS? How long do some of these different PFAS last? What do these PFAS break down into? And we have a lot more of my answers end up being, well, we don't know that yet. And that's partially due to this fact that the PFAS have, you know, kind of really hit the scientific radar, let's say, in the last 7 to 5 years. Now, they've been around for a lot longer, right? Kind of created back in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. But a lot of the research around these PFAS has really been done in the last, 6 to 10 years.
I understand that you're involved in a new project that would aim to track PFAS contamination in water in areas known to have higher levels. Is treating PFAS in drinking water somewhat limited in the effectiveness if other bodies of water throughout the state contain high levels of these chemicals? How does it cycle through the environment?
So PFAS can get into our environment a lot of different ways, and it can, you know, easily get into our rivers or our drinking water, groundwater, because it is very soluble. So some of them can actually move far distances. Some of the short chain PFAS can move, quite a ways, where some of the long ones might move slower or less distance. But majority of the issue about PFAS is it gets into our drinking water, it gets into our surface water, it can be in our soils, it can also be transmitted through the air. So we can kind of think right now some of these PFAS are actually ubiquitous or kind of all over the environment. So when we're thinking about trying to treat a single area for PFAS contamination, we might be missing potential sources that could be coming in the future.
And you have to protect the sources that are still clean, I would imagine. I mean, with the town of Campbell trying to tap an aquifer that seems to, at the moment, be not penetrating with PFAS, how would you approach that in terms of making sure that that source of clean water stays clean?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And the hardest part about PFAS is because it does last so long, different types of these PFAS, you know, they move through the environment at different rates. It's important for us to know what those concentrations are and, like, as you just mentioned, an untapped or a quote unquote clean source, and to be able to monitor that to ensure that it's not being contaminated later on through a source that already exists. So there's a little bit of this idea of continuing monitoring to make sure that we are protecting what is clean, as well as remediating the areas that we do know that have high levels of PFAS.
Oh, continued monitoring then. So if you're testing a municipal water system, you would want to get on a schedule to continually test it to make sure that it is still safe?
Yeah. So I like to kind of say is the first issue with PFAS, right, is just do we know if it's there, as I kind of had already hinted at. So if we can continually monitor, you know, what the levels of PFAS are, that can give us a really good indication of if that source is being continuously contaminated or potentially being contaminated by a new source or something like that.
The work that you're talking about takes scientists, takes a group of scientists. It takes researchers at universities as well, everyone working together. We're seeing what's happening at the federal level with the Trump administration set to lay off 10% of NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's workforce. And that's according to latest estimates by the Associated Press. What impact could cuts have in addressing PFAS pollution?
That's a really, really interesting question to think about. And So PFAS are not just a single issue, right? We're talking a little bit about PFAS in our groundwater, but you know, it's in a whole bunch of different areas. And so if we are going to be limiting the ability for us to do research on it or the science behind it, that could have some huge impacts moving forward. And in particular, right, we think a lot of this stuff as, you know, a single issue. So for something like impacts on humans, but if we take more of this one health approach and kind of like, how is this impacting the environment? How is this impacting our, you know, humans? How is this impacting the wildlife? And it takes all of these different scientists to kind of come together to try to answer all of these questions together. So it's going to take a lot of the research scientists and a lot of, you know, collaborative thinking as we kind of move forward. So I think it's very essential that we, you know, have a large group of people that are looking at this from a lot of different angles.
Gavin, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Gavin Dehnert is an emerging contaminant scientist with Wisconsin Sea Grant and UW-Madison. Now we hear from a community along the Mississippi River. Residents of French Island in La Crosse County have been relying on bottled water and fighting PFAS contamination for 5 years. Lee Donahue is the Town of Campbell's Health, Education, and Welfare Supervisor. Lee, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
When we last talked in June, the town of Campbell was exploring the Mount Simon Aquifer that could serve as a potential source for clean water for the town. Has this turned into a solution?
Well, it's well on its way. We are very excited to announce that we will be drilling our first municipal well within the next month, and that will begin our municipal water system so that we will be able to have safe long-term water for all Campbell residents. It's really an exciting time.
What does that feel like for you?
Ooh, it's so exciting to see that this is actually happening after all of these years. But I think we needed the time to explore what the options were going to be, what the most cost-efficient option was going to be for our residents, and what was going to provide us with the safest source of water. So Campbell will be the only municipality in our region, other than La Crescent, Minnesota, that taps into this much deeper Mount Simon Aquifer. So Mount Simon Aquifer has been used in La Crescent for roughly 2+ decades. And so it will be really, really exciting to eventually be able to turn on our taps again and safely drink what comes out.
Eventually, because drilling is one thing, but when would municipal water be up and running?
We are pushing for our system to be up and running at the end of 2027. And I know that seems like a long time away, but compared to where we were in October of 2020, people are going to see this within their lifetime. And that was a question that many people asked all along, right? How long is this going to take? And will I ever see it come to fruition?
Can you touch on affordability? Is this affordable for local residents, for residents of French Island?
That has been one of our priorities, to make certain that it is affordable. So we use a variety of different funding sources through the state and through the federal government, much of which has already been awarded, so that it will be affordable for our residents.
Why is drilling this well the right solution for the PFAS problem?
Well, it will provide the safest source of water, right? We have neighboring communities that are also beginning to find PFAS in their water supplies. It doesn't make sense to connect to somebody who has the same problem that we do. We feel that the best option for us is to go into a separate aquifer that is 100% PFAS-free.
And you're also looking to reconfigure the town in a way. Last fall, close to 900 people in the town of Campbell signed a petition to have the town be incorporated as a village. Why is this an important step, and how is it connected to PFAS?
Well, in some ways it is and it isn't.
Okay.
Most importantly, if we become a village, or I'm going to say when we become a village, it maintains Campbell's independence. We've been an independent municipality for almost 200 years, and it seals our borders from annexation, which is very important. It also preserves all of our high-performing services. We have our own police department, our own fire department. We do our own zoning, and we really want to keep our affordable tax rate and also to preserve our heritage.
And so would you be the village of Campbell, or would you be the village of French Island?
Well, we've talked about becoming the village of French Island. When you say Campbell, most people think soup. They don't think Sipality. And so, you know, when you talk to someone who lives here, they will always say, I live in French Island. And we think that becoming the village of French Island is going to be a spectacular achievement.
Is dealing with PFAS contamination a one-size solution for communities? And by that, is what French Island is going through the steps, similar steps that Peshtigo or Wausau or another community battling PFAS would arrive to a similar solution?
No, it's not. That's the one insidious thing about PFAS, is that everybody's circumstances are different. The hydrogeologic features of where they live are different. You know, my compatriots up in Peshtigo have been fighting this even longer than we have, for more than 8 years. And I was just told the other day that Hale's Corner is now experiencing some PFAS issues as well. So our solution isn't necessarily a template for other communities. However, the research that we are doing with UW-Madison, USGS, and Wisconsin Geological Survey will help serve as a template for the DNR to be able to look at how PFAS plumes move in a variety of geologic areas, and to see how fast plumes are moving and the directions that they move. And hopefully that information will help provide those other communities additional information so they can figure out what their long-term solution is going to be.
Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Lee Donahue is the town of Campbell's health, education, and welfare supervisor. The town is preparing to drill a municipal well in the coming weeks, and this will enable private well owners to have access to tap water that doesn't contain harmful PFAS chemicals. Earlier, we spoke with Gavin Dehnert, who is an emerging contaminants scientist with Wisconsin Sea Grant and UW-Madison.
We've been learning about the latest ways that Wisconsin is addressing the problems with PFAS contamination in drinking water, and we want to hear from you. What is the drinking water quality like in your area? Has your community found PFAS in the water supply? And what questions or concerns do you have about your tap water?
You can leave a voicemail or text us with your comments at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232. Or you can email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.